Are you wearing the Kendo armor to podcast, Jonathan?
I am not, unfortunately. Okay. I do have a funny story, though. So on my team at Apple, there was a guy during his phone interview. He actually suited up because he wanted to take the phone interview seriously. Never mentioned that you would never wear a suit to an Apple interview one way or another, but...
That's hilarious. I could see myself doing that. I, like, every now and then when I need to go to the bank, I actually dress up. Not a lot. But, you know, if I'm just wearing a t-shirt, I'll put, like, a nice shirt on and try to look presentable.
I used to do that for customs. Whenever I would pass through customs not properly shaved and not, like, dressed very well, they'd think that I was a web developer trying to sneak into the U.S. for work. But if I dressed up nicely, they never gave me a second look.
That makes sense.
No one well-dressed is going to go to America to work. Jonathan, where does the name Tumult come from? It sounds almost arduous.
I guess I started out doing comic books, and so I thought Tumult sounded like a great name for a comic book company. So in fifth grade, I was just thumbing through the dictionary, found this word, and thought, yeah, that would really fit in for a comic book company. And I've kind of kept the name with me everywhere I've gone since.
That's awesome. A guy used to work in a comic book store, actually not far from where I lived. And that kind of harkens me back to when Jim Shooter had his independent line called Defiant for a couple of years. Right. There were just some really awesome names for those companies.
So when I feel like it also fits in with Mac software naming companies. Now you've got like Panic and you have, you know, or Unsanity. So I feel it fits in there too.
Yeah, that makes sense. So, wait, when you were a kid, you were into comics more than, I was going to say nerdy stuff, but...
I was really more into drawing comics, so I got my original business chops drawing my own comics and selling to other, like, fifth and sixth grader students. And that was how I made some money. Like, back as a kid, there was this fair at my elementary school called the Pumpkin Patch Festival, and... it was like an arts and crafts fair. And so there was this little flyer that they handed out like, oh, if you're into selling arts and crafts, you know, sign up, you can get a booth. And I thought, arts, well, that must mean the comic books that I draw. So I called them up like, and this was me as, you know, I guess I had just turned like 12 years old at the time being like, oh, you know, can I get a booth and sell my comic books? And they actually agreed to it. And so myself and a few friends helped man the booths and we sold comic books that we had drawn and Xeroxed and stapled together and put in those little, you know, the plastic comic book holders with the cardboard.
Yeah. That's really cool. Now it is a lot of work to do a comic book. Like we, like 22 pages worth of artwork. It's like, that's not a joke. Did you spend like a long time on it?
I did six and they were like, well, yeah, I mean, my recollection was it was probably about a month's worth of effort of drawing and inking and figuring out how the whole thing goes together. I had helps from friends, though, so it wasn't just me. I had one friend who did another comic that we sold under the same Tumult label, and then I had a couple other friends help me with inking, and there was one that drew one of the characters inside the comic book, so it was really a company effort back at that tender age.
Was it like a superhero book or what?
So I was a little bit more into Japanese animation, and one of the big influences was a little bit more of the kind of sci-fi Blade Runner-esque worlds that were there. So it was more about androids and the trials and tribulations of cybernetic beings. If you go back and read it, it really doesn't make much sense, I have to say. I have no idea what I was trying to accomplish with them, but at the time, it was my attempt to draw.
So how'd you transition from, you know, comic book artist into doing technical stuff?
Actually, I'd say it was definitely a gradient of transition. Through my art, I like doing a lot of special effects and video editing on the computer. And so I really got into doing video. And in fact, whenever there was like a class project in high school, I'd always make sure that, you know, I was doing a video and would be published on tape. But I would do all the editing on a computer. So I was working with computers all the time. And I just got really curious on how do these things even work. So I took
what, what kind of computers were you doing at the time?
So my mom was actually really forward thinking about investing in me and my education. So she always made sure I had the latest computers. And so at the time she had gotten me, it was a Quadro 660 AV, which was like, it was the pizza box. It was actually the Centris Macintosh box, but it was a Quadra. I don't remember. I think it was maybe 25 megahertz or like 33 megahertz. But the neat thing about this was the AV. So it had composite, like the RCA jack plug. So you could actually plug in a camera at the time. And this was before digital. This was before FireWire. But you could plug in cameras and then record and capture video that you took.
I loved that. My first Mac was a PowerPC G3, which with an AV stuff on it. And I loved doing that. Just plugging in the camera or plugging in like your VHS and just recording from the composite, would like it felt amazing.
Yeah, I mean, it was astonishing that me, as I guess at the time I was probably 13, 14 years old, I could do editing, which was almost on par quality wise with what you would find on television. Like you could do blue screen effects, and you know, I used to do, I mean, maybe it was a little bit of the Star Wars boy, but I'd you know, take like a phaser and do, you know, rotoscoping. Like phaser shots from it and just really create all kinds of different effects. Sometimes I try integrating 3D. There was a program called Infinity that I loved back then. So yeah, I really approached computers more from the artistic and desktop video angle. Mm-hmm. And it was through that I decided, like in my high school, I was really fortunate enough that they offered an Intro to C course and an AP Computer Science course. So I took both of those. And so I got really wrapped up into programming and just kind of fell in love with it, especially after watching. I don't know. Have you seen a video called Triumph of the Nerds?
Yeah, but I haven't seen that in a long time. That's pretty old school.
Yeah, so it was this documentary by Robert Cringely, who I think he still blogs on the internet.
Mm-hmm. Is he a guy or is he a persona?
So Robert X. Cringely is a persona, technically speaking, but I don't think you can really separate the persona from the guy at this point.
Okay, I thought it maybe had swapped people every now and then.
Yeah, like a Time Lord.
Like Dread Pirate Roberts.
Right. Yes. So anyway, but yeah, it's his, this was like what, mid-90s kind of thing, right?
Yeah, I think may have been 95, 96. It was before Apple had bought Next, I'm pretty sure, because on my VHS recording, which was a couple years later, it was like the breaking news of the time, like at the commercial break, was that Apple had bought Next. And so it was clearly done before that.
I just looked it up. Triumph of the Nerds, Rise of Accidental Empires, 1996.
Yeah. And it was just one of these fantastic documentaries that they covered a bunch of different topics in computer history, which is a little bit of a hobby of mine. But the really neat thing is showing how these people who were just, you know, suburban kids working out of their garages had a few smart ideas and were able to build a whole industry. And that to me was just an astonishing thing. And I wanted to be a part of that. And the part that really spoke to me the most was discussion around the notion of like a killer app, that you might have the technology, but unless you have an application, a legitimate use for something, the technology was useless. And so I always thought it was neat how just at the right time, the right place, you could build an application and that could change an entire industry. And the main killer app that they talked about in the series was the spreadsheet. It started with VisiCalc, and that just opened the door for the entire computer industry. Suddenly you went from hobbyists playing around with blinking lights and numbers to computers being everywhere in every business and every home. Due to this one application, which wasn't specifically VisiCalc, because VisiCalc's been pretty much lost to the history books now. It turned into, I guess, Lotus 1-2-3, and eventually Excel really took over. But that application is what made the computer industry.
I remember as a kid watching my father use VisiCalc on the Apple II and then going to sleep and waking up in the morning and watching him still using it when I woke up.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny because there was all the talk of people wanting to get programming more into education, but honestly, doing spreadsheets is very much a programming environment. And so I think there's a lot more programmers in this world than most people even realize due to that fact.
Yeah, I know a lot of people who do Visual Basic inside the Office suite. Mm-hmm. They don't really call it programming, but they like to mess around with it, and they kind of get the bug. Sometimes they graduate, and sometimes, get out of the shoebox, but sometimes they don't.
Yeah. They're doing macros and games.
So did you have an idea? Exactly, yeah. Did you have an idea for a killer app, or did you just sort of fantasize about coming up with a killer idea?
So back then, it was a lot of fantasy. Actually, when I was learning to program, I took Intro to C, and you only get so far in a high school course. So I didn't really learn too much from Intro to C. But like the very first week when I took the next year's course, which was AP Computer Science, the very first concept was two-dimensional arrays. So that's you can access data in rows and columns. And when I saw, oh, there's this two-dimensional array structure, I could build a spreadsheet with this, and I could recreate the original app. So that was one of the first real like independent projects I did off on my own, was making a spreadsheet. Never mind the fact that you could actually, had I thought about it with a one-dimensional array, I could have done two dimensions. Like, we'll ignore that fact for right now.
Yeah, but that's the kind of enlightened thinking that you get to after a bit of experience in the field, right?
Yeah, so I did a command line version first because we were using, it was in MetroWorks. You use something called SIOUX, which was SIOUX, Simple Input Output User Exchange. That's how you, on the Mac days, that's how you would emulate using like a terminal.
Yeah, it looked like so you could get your printf and your scanf and all of it.
Exactly, yeah, and that's how you did it back then. And then I got a couple books on like Macintosh programming for System 7 and learned about event loops and how to actually draw a window, which the moment you have that first window on your screen, that's like 10 times more beautiful than any Hello World has ever been. It's like I can, make a window appear on my desktop. So there's a lot of joy from that. And I eventually did a spreadsheet that was a fully graphical interface. I even made like the icons for it. I made a little user manual. I didn't really sell it to anyone, but kind of went through the exercise of making an entire application. That was a lot of fun.
That's great. Yeah. I guess that's a reasonably complicated application to be making too. Especially with the way the toolbox was at that time. It's not like you just drop a control down and get a spreadsheet.
Yeah. I mean, you had to do all the custom drawing of all the cells. Right. Don't even remember the text fields were pretty primitive then too. But I supported a few different formulas. You could like sum, you could average, you could address cells. So there was a certain amount of parsing that you had to do to understand what was actually in the cells. I remember it being over 2,000 lines of code, which for a high school project is nothing to sneeze at.
Yeah, no, that's quite a bit. That's impressive. So I got to say, making a spreadsheet is your first thing. It's not the most rock and roll kind of move.
Well, to me, I mean, after watching Triumph of the Nerds, it seemed like that was the application.
That is time. Cool. Yeah. So what was the next project? Like you must have, when you hand it in and you've got that, the feeling that you get when you ship something, right? Like it's done and it's out of your hands and now it's sort of, it's for others to sort of gauge how good it is, right?
Yeah, I mean,
go ahead.
So the next thing, so that one I didn't really, ship to anyone. It was more I did for myself. I clearly showed people, but it wasn't any better than, spreadsheets, like whatever was included in ClarisWorks at the time or, Excel. So it was kind of the exercise in doing it, but it never really blossomed. But the first thing I had where I really had that satisfaction of shipping something and seeing people use it was at a part-time job I had. I guess I had it like junior and senior year in high school. So we'll take a little trip back to the late 90s. It's kind of the dot-com boom. Mm-hmm. I grew up in St. Louis, which isn't really the hub of technology, but there's a few things in St. Louis, one of which was a startup called StreamSearch.com. Mm-hmm. And I'm guessing no one has ever heard of StreamSearch.com.
No.
So it bit the dust long ago. But their idea was that there was a lot of streaming audio on the internet that was happening at the time. So I don't know if you remember Real Audio.
Oh, yeah. Buffering.
Which later became like Real Video and, buffering, exactly. on a 56K connection, at, you know, at best, all you could really do is buffer.
Right.
But their idea was that there was this boom in streaming audio, and someone should index it and provide a search engine. This was really, I think, a reasonable idea that, I mean, it's almost like YouTube, but for audio is really what they were trying to do.
Right.
The problem is how they did it. Unlike Google, which has a web crawler that basically goes around and scrapes all the different sites across the internet and builds an index automatically, they decided they would have humans do the crawling and go around the internet, find sites with the streaming audio, and then laboriously enter it in to their database. With the advantage being at least the content they had would be curated. So you would have these nice human descriptions on the content.
Right. And that's because they couldn't figure out how to pull anything automatically from like pretty primitive websites, I guess.
Yeah, I don't think they quite had the technical chops to know that this was a bad idea and using manpower in general when you have computers to do the work for you is
bit of a,
not
bit of a non-starter. Right.
Yeah. So, I mean, there were definitely issues with the company, but I think the general idea of, well, of YouTube clearly to this day is sound. Yeah. That's what they were trying to build. Yeah. But again, they had all this human effort. And when you're going through tons of audio on the internet, most of which is music, so like track listings from songs that people are posting, most of the descriptions are going to be the same. It'll be something like, this is the song Ice Cream by the artist Battles from the self-titled album Ice Cream. That's like all the descriptions were. And then you could kind of switch it around. So it's like from the self-titled album Ice Cream or Battles, whatever comes this and this. And so there were a few different variations, but ultimately all these human descriptions that were supposed to be great ended up being exactly the same.
Right.
And part of this is due to there's only so much you can do. And also they incentivized these human people who were working, and I was one of them, that the more you entered in, the more you would get paid. So you would get some base level hourly rate, and then you would get, I think it was 10 cents for every piece of content you entered in.
Right. So punching it up is not worth your time.
Exactly. And they, you know, to their credit, they even tried gamifying this. So they would have leaderboards and say who was doing the most. And the top people could do about, I think, 60 an hour. So they would earn about an extra $6 an hour. And the kind of lower echelon of people would do about 10 to 15 an hour as far as entering in this data. And that's typically how it went.
16 hours is quite a lot if you think about it. It's like a minute per thing, and just you're just churning through it at that point.
Yeah, I mean, the goal was to find a site that had a lot of it, and then, yeah, you would just copy and paste and churn through it. And if you could type really fast, you could get it in.
Yeah.
And so I was not the fastest typist. I think in my best, I could do about 20 to 30, which was about average.
Mm-hmm.
But then it's one of these things where, well, we can automate this, right? So given an artist, an album, and a title, and maybe like a year, if I had that information, I could just write this little JavaScript or this little HTML web page that had some JavaScript where you enter in this data, and then it gives you the description you can copy and paste in. So you're saving a lot of typing time.
Hmm.
And many times it would just be the variation would be on like the song title. So you've already entered in the artist, album, and year. And so you only need to copy and paste one piece of data and get a different string out. And it could kind of randomize the format of the string and choose between 5 or 6 different variations. So it sounded very human-like.
Nice.
So I thought, well, you know, this will help speed things up. And I was enjoying programming at the time. So I did this. And then I pretty much gave it to a few friends who were also working there.
Nice.
And they started using it. And then the next day I came in and I saw pretty much everyone in the office, even people I hadn't given it to, using this application. That was just like the best feeling in the world to me that I could write something that could actually improve people's lives and make them more money as well. And so that was really my first legitimate experience of someone using software I had written to their own advantage. And I loved that feeling. And I knew from that point on, yeah, I'm definitely going to, you know, go do CS. I'm going to build my own company. And from that point, I was really set on what I was going to do.
So you've been set on building your own company since since the comic book days, really.
Pretty much, yeah. I've always had that bug.
Yeah, you've got a... Does that come from anywhere? Is there any kind of experience in your life that explains this entrepreneurial sort of spirit, or is it just something natural that you get?
I mean, it may have been some of those early formative experiences where I wasn't, when doing comic books, it's not like I was necessarily pursuing it per se, but there were comic books, they cost money. As a kid, you always want money to buy video games. So maybe it was just something that snowballed and yeah. I realized I could do it. Genetically, my grandfather and his brothers actually had their own business. So I think, you know, either as part of my family, I was influenced by them, or, you know, maybe there's just the entrepreneur gene. I'm not too sure. So maybe that was part of it.
Yeah. Well, just having family members that do run their own business lets you know that that's just something that you can do, right? Like,
yeah, exactly.
It's not a weird out of the box thing. So you've determined to have your own business. And so you go to CS. Where'd you go to school?
I went to Purdue. So I grew up in St. Louis, and I pretty much drew a 300-mile radius circle around St. Louis because I wanted some place within driving distance so I could go home. And there were a couple schools that were decent for CS. Purdue was one of them. I didn't have to do too much work to get in, which was nice. I wasn't the best student in the world.
Yeah, I'm a student. So that's great. So did you enjoy it? Like, what did you get out of it? Like, not just the technical side, but did you sort of come to a realization that software is not what you really expected, or you know, things work differently in the production environment kind of thing?
So, you know, the biggest thing I got from Purdue was practicing kendo, I have to say. So this goes to the singleton talk where I talked a little bit more about kendo, but yeah, kendo is actually
totally out of left field when you started talking about kendo. I'm like, oh, this is awesome. So cool. So yeah, go ahead. I didn't mean to cut you off.
So kendo is like Japanese fencing. It's pretty much a way for samurai to practice their swordsmanship without killing each other. So they use bamboo swords and armor, so you can still go full contact and not actually slice the bone. And so at Purdue, I have to say, like, I had done quite a bit of programming. Like, I had started a lot of my own projects. And so the CS aspects of it, while I definitely learned some, didn't really have a big influence in how I went about programming or what I went about learning. I was always doing projects independently.
Right.
Yeah. And those, to me, were far more educational than the schoolwork that I had. In fact, it was somewhat disappointing that I was in high school, all these kids had them. I had some other various ventures in high school as well. But you get to college and everyone's really poor. And so I was kind of at a loss for what to do because I couldn't sell, you know, whatever I was selling to college students. And so that was a little disappointing. But I got really wrapped up in kendo, which was a completely different mindset. So kendo practice itself is a lot like boot camp. It's physically challenging, but even more so, it's very mentally challenging. So I think I learned a lot about, you know, just working hard through kendo and being tough through kendo.
So what appealed to, like, how do you walk into a kendo class cold? You know what I mean? Like, where does that come from? It doesn't seem like something that's just like an obvious thing to do.
So as someone who, you know, especially in high school, I was at, you know, I'd come home, I'd maybe watch Saved by the Bell or a Star Trek Next Generation episode. But I'd be on the computer most of the time, assuming I'm not, you know, doing things with friends. And so I realized if this is going to be my life, I need to do some physical activity. Mm. And martial arts seemed like a fun thing to do. And so Purdue...
Because you
have really
interested in like Japanese anime and all that? Like you had a...
Yeah, I mean, I had kind of heard about it a little bit. I didn't know quite what it was, but yeah, because of my interest in Japanese animation, like kendo wasn't a foreign word to me.
Got it.
And so I wanted to choose some martial art. And Purdue, actually, one of the really nice things about Purdue is they have this very vibrant club system where anyone at Purdue can start a club. All it takes is like one short form and filing with the school, and you've got a club. And so Purdue had like 250 clubs that you could choose from. And so freshman year, at the beginning of the school year, all these clubs have what they call call-outs. And I think I've never really heard this word before, but a call-out is basically the like an introductory course. And so you can go to as many call-outs as you want. They all like advertise them. They put flyers up all around the school, like Purdue Kendo Club call-out. You know, it's September 20th at this time. Like, and so I saw one of these flyers and I thought I'd go. And yeah, they did
demonstration.
That's cool.
That's a really good idea just to, you know, it's like a buffet of interesting things to, for the students.
Yeah, that's exactly what it is.
Yeah. So you went, I think it's, and you, sorry, go ahead. I cut you off.
Oh yeah. No, I think it's, you know, especially when you're a freshman, you're like new to college. You might not have too many friends. I think there were maybe three or four people from my high school that went to Purdue. So not too many people I knew ahead of time. It's like a great way to become social, get in, you know, get involved, meet friends. That way college isn't such a lonely experience.
Yeah, I think that's a great idea.
Yeah. So I went to the call out and they did this demonstration and it just blew me away. I mean, I would encourage anyone listening to go YouTube a kendo match. And it's like loud. There's lots of shouting. It's extremely violent, but it's also organized in a certain way. And it's very simplistic. There's only a few shots that you actually do. So it's very fundamental and very basic. And something about that, I don't know what it is. Maybe it's the same thing that appeals to me about other aspects of Japanese culture, but something about that just really appealed to me. And I said, I have to try this. So I started doing it. And the funny thing about kendo is the first class, I think a lot of people are really impressed. Like it is when you watch a kendo match, it's an amazing demonstration. So the first class, there was probably 70 to 80 people in the class with me. Mm-hmm. And as I said, it's really tough, both physically and mentally. So then 1 week later, you go to the next class, there was like 40 people. And then, you know, down the road, it's like 20. And by the end of the semester, nearly everyone has dropped out except those who are like really willing to stick with it. So you might end up with like 8 to 10 people from the original like 80 that started out. So the dropout rate's really high because it's extremely difficult. And I think sticking with it is hard because you may love it, but it's one of those things where it's like you're going to do, you know, a 5 mile run or something like that, you know, it's going to be extremely painful right when you do it. And so it just requires a certain amount of mental effort to get over that hump to even do it. You feel great at the end of the practice, but before the practice, you are just dreading how painful it's going to be.
So what, where's the pain come from? Does it come from getting hit in the face or hit in the body with a giant stick? Or is it from like holding the stance and doing the actual strikes?
It's doing the strikes repeatedly. So different kendo dojos, I think, have different emphases on different parts. But at Purdue, the emphasis was really on repeated swinging, not even hitting anyone, just kind of working up the muscles and something called suburi. But it's just fundamental practice of swinging over and over and over and over again. So you would sometimes do 600, 700 swings of a sword just as, and that's the warm up. That's the warm up time. And there's different swinging exercises. The worst is basically you do a squat and swing the sword at the same time. So your feet are planted, which is somewhat unusual. And it's really more of just a practice exercise, but you do squats. And so sometimes you would do 50 to 60 nonstop of these squatting exercises. And I will say that exercise, among anything else, that would always cause people to throw up if they weren't ready for it. So
I shouldn't be laughing, but that does sound kind of...
Yeah, I mean, there were some pretty gruesome stories in practice, but that one would always put people over the edge if you weren't in, you know, just the top shape at the time. So that was a lot of it's just swinging, arm strength. Being hit itself can hurt if you're hit incorrectly, but it's more you feel it and maybe will cause a small bruise than anything else, because you still are wearing armor and it is meant to be a protective sport.
Yeah, so the armor actually works. I mean, that sounds like a stupid thing to say, but it's decent padding, right? It's not like you can actually you can't really break somebody's bone if you nail them hard enough.
Yeah, I mean, even with the sword itself, you won't really break bones because it's a bamboo sword, so it flexes a lot. If you watch kendo in slow motion and you watch a hit, you'll see there's like a 30-degree curve on the bamboo sword at the moment of impact. So it flexes a lot. And really, if you were to not wear armor, it would clearly hurt. It would leave a bruise, but it would more like really just damage up your skin. So a lot of the armor is more just kind of protecting the skin than anything else.
I didn't know that. It just seemed like it would hurt like a son of a bitch. I got hit.
Well, I think what was the MTV show Jackass? I think Jackass will oftentimes take the kendo sword, which is called a shinai, and they'll hit people. So if you want to see what it's like to be hit directly,
yeah. I've never seen that show, and it's because I don't want to see what it looks like to get hit with a shinai. So did you end up competing?
So tournaments were one of the more fun things to do. So we'd travel to nearby cities like Cincinnati or Chicago, and we'd compete in tournaments. I personally never did that well in tournaments, which was one of my regrets. I kind of wanted to compete. After I did a tournament, I felt like I had learned a lot from it and then wanted to go again. But once you're out, you're out. So I'd have to wait another 6 months and compete again. Tournaments are fun, especially meeting other people practicing kendo.
Right. Is it a tournament-centric sport, or is it more of a training-centric sport? If that makes sense, do you know what I mean? Like,
it's
not necessarily the competition; it's the personal growth.
I would say it's what you want to get out of it. But tournaments are pretty common in the San Francisco Bay Area. I feel like there's a tournament every 3 months or so. And kendo is, while it's no longer a practical martial art because you don't really go around carrying swords. I think the goal is to be a better swordsman, and the only way to be a better swordsman is to really put your skills to the test. Yeah.
That's interesting. Do you still compete, or do you still train at all?
I haven't. Since I moved to San Francisco, I haven't started going to a dojo, but I'll take out my sword and practice swinging relatively frequently still.
Just in the apartment, taking out the lamps and beating on the furniture.
You know, that is, it's really a concern to make sure that I live in an apartment that has a high enough ceiling that I don't hit the ceiling when I practice.
That's cool. That's a good thing to be aware of. So after Purdue, did you go straight to Apple?
Yeah, I did go straight to Apple. I had a couple options at the time, one of which was doing grad school at Purdue, and my goal in grad school as well, kind of hang out and grad school and start my own company on the side, but I didn't really know what I would do at the time. So I figured I'd find some business opportunity. I had a few ideas, nothing that was too clear. I had this little shareware app called HyperEdit, which was like a web editor with a live preview. It was one of the first things using the WebKit SDK. I had a lot of fun doing that. I did sell while I was in college. It was like my first real public app.
Still for sale. It's pretty cool. I tried it years ago, actually. Thought it was neat. I just don't do any web stuff.
Yeah, it's like the little app that can. I had really started venturing down more Apple development in a hardcore sense. That was the dawn of OS X, really.
So you've been using Macs since forever.
I had been using an Apple II since I was like 2.5 years old.
Yeah. So did it just seem natural to keep going with Apple technology, or in Purdue did you sort of, I don't know, get a little Unix-y or something, or like what? Well, you know how like people's taste in platforms change over the years. Did that occur to you, or?
No, my taste didn't really change too much. I had experimented a little bit with a tablet PC in college because there was a course, tablet PC programming, where you'd get, like, Purdue was very much sponsored by Microsoft School. So they had this course that was...
That would have been around the Penn Computing Initiative time, right?
Exactly. Yeah. So, I mean, what's funny is the tablets are not too different than what Microsoft's putting out now. Microsoft was really trying to take this initiative on pen computing, And most of the tablets back then were either like a slate where it was just a screen and you would write with a stylus and would do handwriting recognition. There was no touch input, but it was like Wacom technology. Or it would be like a laptop and the screen could swivel around and you could type and write on the screen. And so they gave everyone in the class one of these Windows laptops. That's cool. I took 6 months and did some .NET programming for the tablet PC, but I didn't really fall in love with it.
The way it worked, or the language, or it just didn't really capture your imagination?
Windows.
Yeah, okay.
I
understand. I just feel like there should be a better answer than that, but that's how I feel. So I just can't get excited about Windows stuff.
Yeah.
So,
yeah, I mean, we did .NET and C# actually were not horrible programming environments back then.
They're way better than that. I don't know if you ever did MFC stuff.
Did a little bit. Yeah.
Yeah, like .NET's way better than that stuff. So.
Yeah, except back then the problem was it had really just come out, so it was very primitive. That as far as the frameworks go, you couldn't do a whole lot with them. And you didn't have good under-the-cover access either. So you could develop relatively primitive applications, quite unfortunately.
Yeah, you needed to drop down into the unmanaged, unsafe C calling stuff, right, in order to get anything fancy done.
Yeah, basically you'd have to use, if you wanted to use things that were more Windows native, you'd have to use like COM objects, and there were some COM bindings, but it was really not very good.
Yeah. What do they call them? Oh, they call them assemblies, right? Not frameworks.
Or, yeah.
No, it's it's note to self. I'm just trying to think it through. Yeah. So you didn't get hooked on Windows, but did you get to do a lot of Mac programming still in university at all, or what?
Not as part of the university curriculum, but...
Because OS X comes out in, what, 2000, basically? 2001, maybe.
Yeah, 2001. And I had used the public betas. It took a while to really get into them because, of course... The public betas or public beta 10.0 were pretty rough. 10.1 was a free upgrade, right? Like you just had to walk into
had to go to Apple reseller and they just give you a disk. Yeah. It was before Apple stores too. So
yeah, it was before Apple stores. They were doing the store within the store program at
yes.
What was the?
I don't know. We're Canadians, so it would be different anyway.
Okay.
Stupid Canada.
There's a Sears job.
I know what you mean. It's like not Circuit City, but like something like that, right?
Yeah, it was something City, Computer City. I don't remember. Some chain that's long gone because you don't really buy computers in stores too much anymore. Minus Apple Store, I guess perhaps is the big one.
Right.
Yeah, Dell really changed that model quite a bit. Yeah, I don't know. I guess because I always had a soft spot for the Mac and I used Macs, I wanted to program on a Mac. And, you know, going back to this whole triumph of the nerds, I still wanted to do the killer app. And I felt, you know, desktop software was exciting. We hadn't quite reached web apps at that point. Like Ajax doing asynchronous JavaScript calls to a server hadn't really been a thing at that point. So you had web pages. You didn't really have web apps. So web programming still hadn't really Ajax? Taken off.
Yeah, that was like Microsoft Outlook in what, 2003, 2004, something like that?
Something like that. It took a while for people to actually catch on that there was this technology that could be used and leveraged, and took time for some other browsers to support it. I think it may have been IE5 was where XML HTTP
was introduced. They had their own separate module, right? Was it an ActiveX module or something that did the HTTP request thing? I forget.
Yeah, I'm not too familiar on the technology because I didn't start using it until much later.
Right. So you choose not to do grad school.
Yeah. So a friend actually, who was 1 year younger, who I guess Mike Thole, he had done some really great software at the time. He did, I think he did like a Kazaa client, and he was at Purdue. So I got to know him a little bit. He did like a Kazaa client. He did this shareware app, I think it was called iSeek, that was like a Google search field that would go in your menu bar. He was a really talented programmer. He got an internship at Apple. And so I thought, I hadn't really even thought about working at Apple. As odd as that sounds, I figured, well, Apple's really more focused on like low-level operating system engineering and doing hardware. I didn't really even think like they do so much software. It just hadn't occurred to me, as funny as that sounds. But he got an internship, and I thought, well, if he can get an internship, I should at least apply to see if I can get a full-time job. Mm-hmm. And that was really mostly in the spirit of keeping my options open at the time of graduation. And so I went on Apple's job website. And, you know, it's funny because Ryan, my co-founder now, actually has an incredibly similar story to me. But I went on the job website. I found maybe about 10 jobs that appealed to me. One of them had an email address that you could email. And the other ones required you to put your resume in like an ASCII form. And my resume was like not an ASCII resume. Like it wasn't well formatted or suited to being a simple textual representation. But with the email address, I could send my PDF to this person. So I shot my PDF to this kind of like special projects recruiter and heard back before I had a chance to even convert my resume to plain text. And they wanted to interview me. And that's pretty much from there I got the job. And, you know, it's one of those things where being such a big Apple user my entire life, it's like, how can I say no to working at Apple?
Which group were you? Special projects, right?
So the group that I joined was something called Software Update Integration, which the name – actually, technically, I was on the low-level Software Update Integration team. So that name is a complete mouthful. It's a horrible name. I mean, what does that even mean, right? But ultimately, what the group did is we worked on software updates for OS X. And made sure ultimately that they worked correctly at a very high level perspective. And so the history of the group was there was a lot of manual QA that this group did. But over the transition to OS X, I think some of upper management realized that manual QA isn't very scalable. And would it be better to hire software engineers fresh out of college to really automate themselves almost out of a job, that they would hire people to do manual QA, but it's like your software engineer, so find a better way.
Right.
And so I joined
this group. That's a lot of the jobs I end up doing is just trying to make sure that nobody hires me again. Well, it sounds stupid, but a lot of it's like, it's, you know, it's rewarding. People keep hiring me, so I guess it's working.
But yeah, I think it's very short-sighted to say like you're, you know, producing complicated code for job security. That is not going to give you job security. That will give you job insecurity if you don't write good code. Like,
yeah. Plus, I would just go crazy. So I don't want to do that.
Yeah.
I'd rather do
that. And I think that was like the point of this group is that they knew if they hired really bright people from college with software engineering or computer science backgrounds that they would go crazy without working on engineering. And so I think, you know, it's a brilliant strategy, I think, for QA in general. And especially hiring people who were perhaps on the younger side. I mean, there were some people who were not fresh out of college, but a majority of the hires were fresh out of college. And it's one of those things where you teach people about software engineering fundamentals, because in college, you don't really get too much software engineering practices. You teach people about quality, how to make sure to write good code, how at a very high level to avoid common traps and pitfalls. Mm-hmm. And because this was a group that looked at what other teams were doing, it required a lot of kind of cross-functional communication as well. So you kind of understand the various different aspects of a large company like Apple and how the pieces fit together. So it was really a brilliant group to start in. And so many people on the team after like 2 years or so would move on and just do amazing work in other areas. Like people moved on to the Pro Apps, to AppKit, to other parts of the operating system and just, you know, really made a name for themselves at Apple as well.
That's great. And it does sound a good place to be able to sort of see how all the, like you said, how all the pieces fit together into sort of almost like you were saying about all the clubs in Purdue. You get to see all of the options that you can you know, go forward with in Apple, because all of the technology ends up touching your group.
Yeah, exactly.
So what do you end up doing? You automated yourself right out of a job and then they fired you, right?
I automated myself into a management job is kind of what happened. So I started managing the team that I was on, and that was pretty early, and I didn't really know what management was all about. I guess to some degree I still don't. I think that's something you're always trying to figure out. But so for whatever reason, they decided to make me the manager of the low-level software update integration team, which ultimately was a few teams in one. One was dealing with the day-to-day aspects of software updates. Another was dealing with some of the automation technology that we owned that other groups at Apple actually used. So we had software that would do UI automation, where it, at a high level, you can do high-level testing, which is automating moving the mouse around, clicking on things, using the keyboard, basically a computer controlling itself for the purpose of testing. And so that was
something you guys wrote custom?
Yeah, something we wrote custom that was completely in-house. The only other company we ever shared it with was Pixar because of the connections between Apple and Pixar. And developers always wanted Apple to do an automation solution.
Yeah.
And Apple really still hasn't done a good one for the Mac.
Instruments has one, kind of. It's not great.
Yeah, so there's a story actually behind that. So Instruments there's two aspects of Instruments, and both our group had a little bit of a hand in at least in inspiring, not in too much of the actual work. So if you use Instruments today and you use it on iOS, there's a framework called UI Automation. And that directly came from indirectly came from the next generation version of the UI automation work that our group did. At one point, we decided to that technology had moved on and there were new things we could leverage. So we kind of redid how we did automation. And that was an amazing project. That later spawned off a lot of continuous integration inside of Apple. But going back to Instruments, so you can do UI automation where you can actually write scripts. And so a lot of the foundation behind that was actually the work our group did. It was re-implemented for iOS, so that group really deserves a lot of the credit. But most of the, or at least some of the original design came from our group and the work we were doing. And then there was another part of Instruments, which I don't remember what it's actually called because I think they renamed it at some point. But you can actually do recording. Let me see.
Right.
So that was a really fun project in trying to get recording and automation done through Instruments. And so what happened, the story behind that and how that got into Instruments started out with a Steve Jobs keynote. So I think this may have been 2005. There was a keynote at WWDC, it was Macworld that Steve Jobs was giving. And there was a failure on his primary demo machine. So when Steve Jobs would give a demo, there would always be two machines. There would be the primary machine and the backup. And that's, of course, if anything happened throughout the demo, all he would need to do is switch over on like a Dr. Bot's KVM switch. He could switch over to the backup machine and just continue going. And So during his keynote, there was one of these failures. I don't remember what the exact problem was, but he made the call like he needed to switch over because something wasn't working. And so he switched over to the backup machine, and nothing on the backup machine had been set up properly. It had been like imaged, but there were per machine independent settings. So all these dialogues popped up. I don't remember what they were, but it was one of them to use this camera.
Yeah. Well, who do you want to fire? And it's just a list box with all the names checked off.
Yeah. So it seemed like this was a problem that we couldn't have two machines that were identically set up. And so my director at the time came to me and she said, Jonathan, what can we do? And she had this crazy idea, like, we need a way to do recording. And I said, you know, her name was Christine. I said, oh, Christine, that's impossible. Like, you can't do accurate recording on OS X. Like, anything changes, like the window position changes, your button's going to be in the wrong place. Mm-hmm. But she had like the seed of the idea of something that was impossible. And so for an engineer, the impossible challenge is like what you're always looking for.
Yeah,
right. That's such a great motivator, is to say that something's impossible and then figure out how to make it possible.
Right.
And so this was actually, so I started looking into what it would take to do recording. And this was, I think in the early 10.4 days, in OS 10.2 in Jaguar, I think they introduced a framework called accessibility.
Yeah.
And it's become a bigger deal now. And I think people are generally aware of what accessibility is for, but and that OS 10 and iOS both have really great accessibility support. But at the time, it was brand new. Not too many apps even knew about implementing it. But the idea is that the applications would expose themselves in such a way that mechanically you could understand the interface. So if you have certain disabilities, let's say you are visually impaired, a program could read the interface out to you and you could select what elements you would want without actually necessarily using a mouse or keyboard or having to have perfect vision of the screen. And that's one use. There are many different uses.
Yeah, it's great. I love that framework. I started playing around with it when it first came out, and I had it so that my app would be running in anything under the mouse. It would be reading in and finding keywords and trying to suggest, like almost doing like real-time Google searches for you.
Neat. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it was kind of goofy and silly, but it was fun. And what I loved about the accessibility thing is that it does a little bit, but it doesn't really expose the visual layout so much as the semantic layout of the app. In that, you can tell it, rather than just being a table view, you can say this is your email list, you know? Or the way it describes the interface is it's not necessarily completely tied to the way that the visuals are. It's tied to an alternative structure that you set up with these AX accessibility objects.
Yeah, exactly. Because sometimes visual structure makes sense visually, but it doesn't make sense for how you would use the computer non-visually. Or sometimes you have a lot of kind of visual cruft that gets...
Yeah, the text fields that refer to like a text input box, that it's great. And it makes sense visually because they're right next to each other. But when you're reading out the UI, it's great to be able to have them explicitly connected.
Yeah, exactly. And that can give a lot of hints because let's say you're using a screen reader and you just come across the text field, you really need the label to make any sense of it. And so by programmatically setting up these connections, you can provide significantly more useful data to users.
So you use the accessibility framework in order to implement recording?
Yeah, so the neat thing there is I basically used three technologies altogether. So Apple had this accessibility, which is a way of looking at the screen. They also had something through AppleScript called system events, which was actually a way to call into accessibility. And so what you could do is you could write Apple scripts that would actually kind of run through the interface and could technically push buttons and type text in, although that part was relatively primitive. But it could also do things like figure out what the dimensions were. So I wrote this little app that anytime you would take either a mouse input or a keyboard input, it would use a technology called event taps and kind of capture any mouse input or keystroke. And what it would do is while it's capturing this, it would look underneath the hood and say, like, let's say it's a mouse click, what button did you click on via accessibility? So it wouldn't record the screen dimensions of where you clicked. It would figure out what the accessibility element in its parent group and its window was. And once it figured that out, it would actually write it out in this AppleScript system events code so that it could be played back via AppleScript. And then there was a little hook that the accessibility events that you would then trigger, like the clicks and stuff, weren't very good at that time. So I had a little hook that would basically replicate the mouse click to give it high fidelity. And so this was actually a hack I did. And it was one of the first all-nighters I had ever pulled in my entire life programming. I never pulled an all-nighter in college, but I kept getting deeper and deeper and figuring out ways to make this recording technology actually work. And basically in the morning, it became like, you know, it was about 7 a.m. when I was kind of finishing in a good state to record something, but no one gets in at 7. So I had to like wait around the office for another 3 hours to get in for me to show it off. It was very hard to stay awake at that point. So I had this technology. I think for the main purpose, like recording probably wasn't even the right technology for solving the initial problem of making sure Steve Jobs' demo machines were in sync. But I ended up making that as one part of an internal app that could then be used for this purpose. But this technology in general was pretty useful. It was useful in two ways. One is that it showed for writing automation scripts, recording is such a great entry point. And I think you can write out automation scripts by hand, and that's a pain in the neck. But if you have recording, then it's kind of like a tutorial on how to actually write those things out, and generally will give you really good input. So the first insight was that recording is just one of these things where if you do some action and it lays out what it is, even if it's not 100% perfect, it's a lot easier to edit what's recorded, and it will teach someone doing the recording how to use the product. And so recording is something that's kind of stuck with me since that point. Even Hype, which is our HTML5 animation tool, it has a big record button. So you move things around and it does the auto layout of keyframes and animation. So I just love like recording just as an aspect, I think is so useful. But it ended up that I guess it was actually the automator team. It wasn't even instruments at that point. It was the automator team was looking at ways to improve Automator on OS X. And Automator is kind of, you would call it like an AppleScript front end. It isn't really. It was kind of a way to automate the system. And it's really a wonderful tool that I don't think was ever used as much as it could have been. But they were in the developer tools team was where Automator was located. And it turned out that they were just like on the same floor, a couple offices away from us. So we would talk with those people a lot. And they really liked this idea of being able to record actions and play them back. And so they took my prototype and kind of re-implemented it so it'd be, you know, good production code that could work as part of the operating system. So I don't think any of my code is necessarily in that. But they took that idea and the fundamentals of what I did, put it in Automator and then later Instruments. And so that's the other part of like kind of automation that you can do.
I'd forgotten that Automator could do that. That is cool. Yeah. So how'd you find management? Because I moved into management at one point and now I don't.
You know, I think I go through waves where, because I really enjoy programming and the creative aspects and seeing something that I have as an idea come to life through my own hand. I really love programming. And I go through phases where I love programming, and then I realize that there's more that could be done if it wasn't just me. You know, I think there's different ways of looking.
Oh, yeah, don't get me wrong. Teams are great. I ended up dealing with, you know, people wanting the divide between their desks to be like a foot taller kind of thing, which is not really what I signed up for. What was involved in your sort of day-to-day management stuff?
So I guess thinking back, I had a few different management roles at Apple from time to time. I think a lot of what I did was Well, I would say the work I was actually, probably I should talk about the work I was most proud of as a manager. And so what I was most proud of was actually starting initiatives, organizing them, and then letting engineers kind of run away with them. So one of the initiatives was this next generation way of doing UI automation. And that eventually blossomed to be much bigger than it was. So it started out as this app that could do basic, you know, keystrokes and mouse clicks. And then we started combining different technologies that the group had done over time and refining those. And so, you know, day to day, it was figuring out who's doing what components do we need to build to glue these components together, or what components do we need to replace, and then fleshing out with engineers what the structure should be, what the requirements should be, getting people together. And so eventually this really snowballed. And this is one of the things I'm most proud of at Apple, from this little idea of trying to make quick tests that would be easy to run. Like, there's a whole psychology to writing tests to get people to actually do them. But the project was geared towards making it so tests would be easy to run. But then we kept tying in more and more components until we got to this holy grail of automation, where the moment you commit a change, it will fire off tests running on different machines, all doing automation, then reporting the results back to you. And I think there's a difference. Most people think of this as continuous integration, and that's really what it was. We were building an OS-level continuous integration system. And there's a big difference between continuous integration at the notion of, you know, one Xcode application that you're building versus an entire operating system. And so there was a lot of work that we did to get it so that teams across Apple would adopt this, be actually writing their own tests and also sharing their own tests. And so a lot of what I did as a manager was getting either my team in the room building some of the core components, or getting other teams in the room to say, okay, here's how we're going to test third-party components with this, or you need this data, like, you're responsible for these aspects. So, I mean, there was, I guess that's what I actually loved doing, was getting people together and fleshing out the design of building something that's bigger than what any individual could build. And
that
so,
sounds really
and that's what I love doing as a man.
Yeah, that sounds great. Because that actually, you're setting direction, and you're sort of, again, it's like that app that you wrote at your first job where you're actually helping all the people around you succeed at their jobs.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, really there's a lot of discussion on what is a manager, especially in a software engineering realm. And I heard it once, I don't remember who said it, but really a software engineering manager has two distinctive parts, especially at a company like Apple. One is the management, which is keeping things running smoothly. And the other is the leadership of putting things in a different direction. So they're really completely at odds, and it's usually encompassed within one person. So you have, you know, inside of you this duality of you need to keep whatever you have working going smoothly. And you also need to get things in a different and innovative direction. Otherwise, you as a team will not be that interesting. I mean, software flourishes on new ideas and creativity.
Right. That's good. That's it's an astute way of putting it. I hadn't heard it put quite that way before.
Yeah. And so I think it's easy for managers to keep things running, to take whatever was there. It's, you know, I inherited the team and the team I was on, so I kind of knew what the team was there for. But it's harder to be bold and take things in a new direction, take that risk and that leap. And I found each time I did, that was the fun part.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So how long were you at Apple for?
Total, I was there about 6.5 years.
That's a good career.
Yeah, it was a long time. My last year there, I was working on Mail for OS 10, managing kind of the core components there. They seem to be in deep shit right now.
I wasn't going to bring it up.
Yeah, I feel sorry for the team. I can imagine what they're going through.
Well, I mean, so let's take an aside there. While I was kind of into Gmail exposing itself via IMAP initially, the more I think about it, the more I just think it's a bad idea. Because they don't have an IMAP backend. And it seems like a lossy idea, right? It seems like it's rife for data loss.
It is a bad idea. I think it was a good idea when they did it because they wanted people to use Gmail.
Right.
And they saw that as part of their strategy. But yeah, it's really not in the model of IMAP, and they're shoehorning it in.
I feel like they should have extended IMAP in some way. Maybe.
So actually, they did extend it in a couple ways. So, and I'm kind of reaching back in my knowledge, but Google is, and they may have done more since I left, but Google actually had some IMAP extensions that would help indicate, I think some of it would like help indicate what folders were useful for what, which is something that IMAP was generally missing. If you go from one IMAP client to the next, you'll end up with, you know, maybe five different sent messages folders all spelled slightly differently.
Dot trash and dot deleted.
Yeah, but ultimately, I mean, their model doesn't fit in too well with IMAP at all. Or at least, you know, in some ways it could, because IMAP actually does have the notion in the spec, and you can look this up in the spec, of having keywords.
Hmm.
The issue is that, one, no client supports them because most servers don't support them well.
Right.
If you look, OS X on 10.7 and later has the notion of flagging, and that uses a really primitive form of keywords where they're supported. But you could theoretically probably shoehorn Gmail in to work better with IMAP, but you would still need a specialized client. No client would work well the way you could shoehorn it in. So yeah, they're just... they've kind of changed how mail works, and they tried going for backwards compatibility, and it's clear mail.app is really a very lowest common denominator mail client. And you have to be for the system, right? Because you can't be too opinionated. Everyone has their own workflows. And if you're providing a system-wide service, that is, you expect anyone using OS X could use this, then you really can't take too strong of opinions, right? And you can't be too specialized. And I think that's why some mail clients like Sparrow that are a little bit more opinionated have been popular with a certain segment of the population. Right. That, and it's because they take the opinions that Apple can't.
Yeah, that's a good way of putting it. I've been using Mail.app since public betas of OS X, or even before that, that crazy OS X server thing that they shipped. But it isn't like an old school app. It like dates back to Next stuff. So I'm kind of not surprised. It's like, you know, there's some rusty edges in there. Well, there have, there were.
Yeah, you know, it's very hard to change mail. And this is something I ran into, that everyone uses, especially at Apple, everyone at Apple uses mail.app. And the moment you make one change, you will broken someone's workflow. So it's very difficult to make any changes at all. And everyone is a shareholder, right? Especially management. And they all have opinions on how mail should work. And so when you take in consideration certain directions you're being pulled in, and then the kind of strings that are holding you back as far as not breaking anyone's workflows, it's very hard to move in almost any direction.
Right.
And you take all the legacy baggage of, yeah, it is a somewhat old application. You have to deal with a lot of different servers and services. And you have to scale, too. I think that's the thing most people don't realize, is a mail archive with 300,000 messages is not uncommon in the slightest. So you need to make sure that you're extremely performant in many different situations. It's really hard to make changes, and most changes you make, people won't want anyways, because people have workflows that are, you know, really deeply ingrained.
And especially, you know, management probably lives a lot of the time in email.
Oh, yeah.
So they're definitely going to have opinions about it. Was that one of the more challenging projects that you worked on at Apple, because it was user-facing so much, or because there were so many stakeholders?
Yeah, it was, you know, I think one of the reasons that it seemed like a good time to leave Apple was actually I felt that a lot of the challenges with mail were not necessarily technical. There were definitely technical challenges. But there was a certain amount of technical debt that had been accrued. It was hard to move it in any certain way. And there were stakeholders. And I suppose, so a lot of the challenges weren't necessarily challenges that
you wanted to tackle. Or, yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like running through molasses. It's just kind of, you could do it, but there's not a lot of upside to it. A lot of point in it.
Yeah. And I mean, maybe had I stayed with it longer, I would have been able to do more with it. But at the end of the day, I think there was the artistic side of me that was aching a little bit and wanted to get in things that were more creative apps.
Right.
You don't think of writing emails as a very creative endeavor in most cases.
Is that where you met Ryan?
Yeah, I met Ryan at Apple. Actually, I met him pretty early on. So when I was doing software engineering on the low-level software update integration team, I also did a lot of various special projects, one of which was helping prepare some of those Steve Jobs keynotes and some of the WWDC State of the Unions that Bertrand would do. And so in doing so, I worked pretty closely with his team. And you know, there was just like one night where after we had, after the first day of WWDC, all the demos and everything went off without a hitch. Like his team did really well. And so I was kind of out with their team and we were drinking and I didn't really, I wasn't really that big of a drinker back then, but we were drinking in celebration. And I just started chatting with Ryan. And I don't know, it was one of those things where I discovered we had so much in common about our opinions on Apple and technology. And he was really well informed and well read on what was happening in technology in the day. And even being at a place like Apple, it was rare to meet someone who was both as well informed, well opinionated, and just fascinating to talk to and to listen to is Ryan. And so, you know, that night, like my recollection is like, as far as friends go, you know, we hit it off. I felt we had a lot in common and I didn't actually start hanging out with him until the next like a year later at WWDC. Like we said, oh, you know, we should do stuff and we hadn't done too much. And then next year about the same thing came around and we worked more closely. And from that point on, we were pretty much, we were set as friends and he lived like one block away from me in Cupertino. So we were pretty close locally, just had a lot of other things in common as well.
That's Andy. Yeah. He's a good guy. Don't tell him that I said that, but
I'll let you edit that part out of the podcast.
Exactly. So you know, you kind of decided you've had enough and you leave. Did you have the idea for what would become Hype before you left, or was the idea like, you know what, I'm going to strike out on my own and set up a company and then come up with, you know, the killer app?
No, the idea was there. In fact, the idea had been there for quite a while in my head, even before, like one of the famous things, and I think this was April of 2010, Steve Jobs wrote a famous essay called Thoughts on Flash, which was like Steve Jobs had, basically he had his own blog. I don't think anyone acknowledges it that he had a blog, but he had like, he would from time to time when something would happen that the community was a little upset about, he would write like a letter that would go on Apple's website. And one of these was Thoughts on Flash. And the big uproar at the time was that Apple was not allowing Flash on its devices. And Flash, of course, way back when was a way that you could do a lot more with the web. Like we were talking before in, you know, the 2004, 2005 days, like you didn't really have web apps. And a big way to compensate was to use Flash for things that the web couldn't do yet. But Flash was, you know, just not very well engineered.
It was slow. The idea isn't bad, but yeah, the actual, like the runtime just got all crufty and kind of crappy.
Yeah, exactly. And when you look at Flash's heritage, it really started as a way to do animations. And I think it just so they got lucky that the web had this need for things that Flash could provide and became a popular plugin. And people started using it more and more.
Like ActionScript gets shoehorned in like version 2 or 3 or something. It's kind of late. Like it's certainly not in the first iteration of Flash.
Yeah. But you know, Flash was definitely not that good. But even before then, it was clear that there was this thing called HTML5. And some articles had come out about the hype of HTML5 and whether it will either be a Flash replacement or what you can do with this general technology. And I use HTML5 rather loosely, I think, as a there's the technical definition of HTML5, and then there's, right. I think, the broader one that includes CSS3 and JavaScript, both APIs and performance improvements. So when I say HTML5, I'm really just referring to this whole nebulous marketing term of
Gen 3 or 4, whatever the web is, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, Web 2.0 caught on as a term. Web 3.0 is really HTML5. That's the term for it, I think.
Yeah, I don't want to coin a term because that then always goes poorly. But yeah, so this level of stuff. Did the idea kind of come out of HyperEdit? Like, was it ever going to be HyperEdit 2.0 or whatever, like the next major version bump? Or were you aware that it's just going to be its own thing?
I think it was going to be its own thing from the get-go. I think probably doing HyperEdit and also a lot of projects in Apple required web-based reporting. So I had a relatively decent knowledge of web technologies from working inside of Apple. Like, that gave me confidence in knowing what web technology was all about. But I never thought of it as an extension of HyperEdit. HyperEdit to me always felt like this is a lightweight HTML editor.
Right.
And really targeted at developers. And I think there was there are these HTML5 technologies that require coding, but there's no reason they should require coding if you're a graphic designer, because you're going to be doing visual things. And if you're doing visual animations or visual layout, you should have a visual tool.
Right.
I had especially taken a trip to Europe, and I love putting together photo websites to experiment around just with new web technologies. And so I had this idea in my head, and I still have the visuals in my head on what I want this photo website to be. But when I got back from Europe, I wanted to arrange these photos and do these animations that would kind of come in three dimensions and fade in and present my photos like a beautifully bound photo album. So I started coding this up. And after about, I don't know, 20 lines of code, it was just like, this is going to be a nightmare to do all these animations. Someone needs to build a tool. Someone who?
So rather than writing 20 lines of code, you wrote 20,000 lines of code and made an editor.
Typical programming programmer's mentality. Yep. Yeah, and I never did the photo website for Europe. That's the thing. I still have it on my like to-do list that I need to do this photo website from a trip I took 3.5 years ago.
That's perfect. That's the perfect programming thing to do. So how long did development of Hype take?
We left Apple in December of 2010. And
you guys left at the same time, right?
Yeah, we were a week apart. His manager somehow convinced him that he needed to stay an extra week. So my manager did not.
Yeah, I was just wondering if it was one of those staggered, like 6 months later, 8 months later. But no, I mean, that's close enough, same time. So you move out. Did you guys have an office initially, or did you just sort of work from home?
No, we decided that – so Ryan was living in San Francisco at the time. He had moved away from Cupertino, but I was still in Cupertino. And so we decided that now would be a perfect opportunity to actually see and explore the Bay Area. So we pretty much coffee shopped up and down the peninsula, working from various little coffee shops or cafes. Just really got a chance to see the San Francisco Bay Area, which is – a beautiful place, has, somewhat distinctive communities and towns. And over time, we found our few spots that we liked. One was in Redwood City, which is kind of halfway between San Francisco and Cupertino, which was convenient, but also just a good working environment, good coffee shop. We were in there. And so we did that for a while. And eventually, we got office space with another company that we knew. We did this startup incubator called Y Combinator. And so we knew a bunch of other startups, and one had some like a spare room in their office in Palo Alto, which is kind of like the hub of Silicon Valley. So we got office space there, and we both got iMacs with, 27-inch screens. And we were so used to working on my MacBook Air with a 13-inch screen, Ryan used an 11-inch screen. And so, like, the very first day when we had both of our iMacs and we were in an office, like, instead of, you know, just spending a few hours in a coffee shop, we, like, ended up spending, I don't know, like, 8 or 9 hours working. And it was just like, oh my goodness, we're so productive now. It was, it was night and day how much more productive you can be when there's less distractions. You have a big screen, you have a place to go. From that point on, we had office space. We eventually moved to San Francisco, got a place in the Upper Hayde, and now we're in a neighborhood called Hayes Valley, which is just a lovely little neighborhood. It's kind of like the mini Paris neighborhood in San Francisco. And we have office space that's somewhat, it's like half underground. There's lots of brick and there's these lights kind of shining up on the brick. So we call it the catacombs because it looks very,
very yeah, I've seen photos of it. Looks awesome.
Yeah, if you're ever in San Francisco, stop by.
Well, I'm there like twice a year, so I will drop by. I'll hold you to it. It took you how long to get Hype out the door?
So we left in December and shipped in late May. So it took about 6 months to get version 1.0 out the door.
Were you happy with it?
Oh, yeah, very much so.
I know that might sound like a stupid question, but you know, sometimes you got to get a 1.0 out and... you know, you realize what you've cut and you, but you were happy with the decisions that you made for 1.0 in the process.
You know, I think a big part of it is getting feedback and the right feedback along the way. So in general, you know, I really think it's very binary. There are some people, especially programmers, who are always kind of down on their work and they'll look back on their work and be like, oh, that was, you know, so terrible. I can't believe I did it this way. I've never been one of those people. If I put something out, it is because I'm proud of it and I think it's good. So I'm not going to put something out that I'm not satisfied with. I think clearly you have, as someone who's creating a product, you have your vision. And that's not always going to match up 100% with what your users need. And so it's really important to make sure to have good ways of getting that critical feedback. And so we started out with a great group of alpha users, and then we did a beta program that just worked out tremendously. So for finding beta users before we shipped, as I said, we were part of this like startup incubator called Y Combinator. And one of the partners of this incubator had actually gone and collected this list of 500 designers, graphic designers around the world. And so we went to him and said, like, hey, can we spam your list and see if anyone's interested in beta testing our product? So even before launch, before we had much of a reputation or, you know, any followers or anything like that, we got some just really great beta users to tell us what was and wasn't important out of the product. And so I think when we launched, we had a pretty high degree of confidence that our product would be useful. We already had sample animations people had built with it. We had found out what the weaknesses were. We had, you know, fixed a lot of bugs. And, you know, 1.0 was clearly a little bit rough. We had to spin a few rapid release updates to fix some issues that were the result of last minute features. But overall, the kind of the whole 1.0 experience, I think, went really well. We were pretty much the first major 1.0 product that was doing HTML5 animations. And so we got a lot of press out of it. And, you know, it's kind of ballsy to name a product Hype, but most reviews said we lived up to it. So
where did that name come from?
That's really
funny. I can't believe I haven't thought to ask you or Ryan that over the years. But yeah, because it's kind of I just pictured it coming from Hyperreddit.
Yeah, you know, it's actually a shame that we have a product both called Hyperreddit and Tumult Hype, because the names are too similar, unfortunately. So I have often thought of renaming Hyperreddit. But so the name Hype really came from kind of the confluence of three different things. The first of which was like those articles I read in like late 2009, early 2010, which all said like, you know, does HTML5 live up to the hype? So hype and HTML5 were two words that were intrinsically always connected in almost every early article about the technology. So that was probably the seed of the idea. The other thing, of course, is Hype being the beginning part of hypertext markup language. But really, it came down to also
that one.
And then, but really also what it would do to your web pages, that you could create more hype on your web pages. But the initial seed of the idea came from all these articles that linked HTML5 and hype, yeah, all together.
So,
I will say you should never choose a single English word as a name, because there's 7 billion people, or almost 7 billion people on this planet. Yeah. Someone will have chosen the same name as you. So we generally refer to it as tumult hype to avoid infringement issues.
Yeah, we've got napkin. I don't think anybody, nobody sued us yet, so that's good. If you look on the App Store, our name is actually like pretty long. It's like napkin, concise image editing or something, or annotation. I love that I can't even remember the name of my app, but whatever. So how did the launch of 1.0 sort of inform the direction and leading up to, I mean, it's not quite recent anymore, but, you know, the more recent 2.0 that you guys put out a couple months ago?
Yeah, so, you know, it's funny because before we launched, I think we had a general idea of the direction we wanted to go. And we've deviated from that direction a little bit due to both the competitive landscape, some features that have come up that we thought might be interesting, the kind of web landscape changing. I think that's one of the advantages we have as a company, is that web technologies are changing and we're a pretty quick company. And so we can adopt new technologies right off the bat. Like when Apple came out with iBooks Author, for example, within a day we had a tutorial on how you could take a hype animation and put it in iBooks Author. And then, you know, it may have been a couple weeks later after we got all the App Store approvals and stuff, we actually had a feature out where you could say export to iBooks Author. So we can do things like that where that wasn't anything on our roadmap originally, because iBooks Author wasn't on our roadmap, but we can do quick shifts. But really, when our roadmap hasn't deviated too much. I mean, we've had feedback and we see what's the most important feedback and always make sure that we integrate that. But ultimately we're, you know, a lot of the path has been paved for us via Flash, right? Like we're trying to do things differently and rethink how you do web animations. But at the same time, a lot of people are coming to us from Flash, and beyond that, Flash had a great number of features that are extremely useful to people. And so it's easy to look at either Flash or other products and say, yes, this feature would be extremely useful to anyone doing this type of work.
Right. I mean, as crazy as Flash can be in terms of the runtime and, you know, the sort of the poorly implemented, it just doesn't exist on mobile and on desktop. It's kind of crappy at times. I've seen a lot of good work done in Flash. Like, it can be interesting. You can do interesting stuff with it, which is why it sort of hype really interests me. I think if you could sort of support the creativity that Flash has typically enabled, you're going to have a really bright future.
Yeah, and that's our goal.
Just to ask the dumb question, was it clear to you that because Flash, back then when Steve Jobs wrote his thoughts on Flash letter, Flash was hugely important. That's why so many people wanted it. Was it clear to you that maybe there would be a need, an absolute need for an HTML5 version that maybe it wouldn't scale to mobile? And it turned out it didn't, but that wasn't really clear back then.
So being inside Apple, I think I had special insight into how bad Flash was. So before his letter, pretty much what he wrote in the letter were things that, at least from the technical sense, were all things that I knew ahead of time. And I was not privy to discussions on if Apple would or would ever not support Flash, but it seemed like a no-brainer that unless Adobe got their act together, And I think that really was an unless. I think everyone thought there was some vendetta Apple had against Adobe, and I don't think anything could be further from the truth. I think Flash was just at the time poorly engineered, and their mobile versions were unfortunately very poorly engineered, not performant, and buggy. And unless Adobe did something about that, it just wouldn't go on the iPhone. And
which wasn't clear from the press, right? Because the press was saying Apple's not allowing Flash on the iPhone, and that's technically not correct. Flash, I mean, they had ample opportunity on mobile, and I think BB10 is the only one that still supports it, and even then it's not great.
Yeah, I mean, really, had Adobe gotten their act together and produced something that was performant and not crashy, Apple would have strongly considered it and probably said yes, because, like, why would they not want a lot of the video on the web to be accessible? Like, for Apple, like, yes, supporting standards like HTML5 is a great thing to do, but ultimately it's about making sure content goes to the users. But Apple wasn't willing to sacrifice the experience of the iPhone at all. And that's one of the big things about the iPhone in general is if you look at the overall design, the experience has almost always taken precedent from things like user interface responsiveness, that you may not have all the content, but darn it, we're going to let you scroll the view anyways. Even if we show a gray checkered box, which was how, you know, the first versions of Safari were, we're not going to show you slow content or content designed for the desktop, which all Flash stuff at the time really was designed for the desktop. There was no notion of touch or control sizes being correct or being able to modify it the same way you could modify a web page to make sure, you know, things like text metrics are displayable to the user. And Apple wasn't willing to compromise there. And had Adobe made the changes that they should have made, we would be in a different world right now. But they didn't. They really failed on their mobile Flash strategy. And nothing's more evident than not just Apple's unsupport, but if you look at, yeah, pretty much everyone else, including Adobe, has abandoned mobile Flash. So I think that's a lesson that they've learned and that they know now. At the time, yeah, everyone was extremely antagonistic towards Apple not supporting Flash. And one of the big things when you got, you know, the original iPhone was you had this amazing mobile internet communicator in your pocket, and you'd want to go check out a restaurant's website, and you would not be able to see a restaurant's website because it was in Flash. And
I love that the iPad, the first iPad demo, when Steve Jobs is sitting in that big comfortable chair on the stage and he's going through the New York Times, and there's that big blue Lego no Flash button, and he just never bats an eye, just scrolls right past it over and over again.
Yeah, I kind of recreated that a little bit. So I've hinted a little bit at this incubator we did, which was something called Y Combinator. And we did that for many different reasons. But to get in, you have to go through like a really quick 10-minute interview process. And so as part of this, I opened up my laptop and just I had their website already open on the page, and I had one of the Flash blockers, so it'd be like a gray where Flash content would be a gray box. And so I just opened it up, and their website was right there, and their website had some Flash content, and you know, they were kind of like behind me, and they just like started chuckling, like, oh shoot, you know, Flash is actually a big deal. So it was showing that is kind of a big incentive that, hey, you need to move away from Flash because it's just not going to work everywhere.
Yeah, it's a great motivator. Yeah. Hey, we're shopping a tool to fix this, and look at this, you jerks. Like, look at your website. So, I mean, I was going to ask about where the future direction is, but I imagine that's going to be governed by what technologies become available, what other platforms come available, and I guess filling in the remaining gaps between what Hype does and what Flash used to do. Is that fair?
I think we're going to go a bit further than that, to be honest with you. But I would be hesitant to comment on future product directions, of course.
Because that's a shitty way to end a show. where do you see the web going? Is that? And I know that's a silly question, but do you have any sort of predictions of where things will be in like in a couple of years, 5 years.
That's a good question.
And I know I'm asking, like, speculation on years out in this industry is like just asking you to step on a landmine. Go ahead.
So the web's actually a pretty interesting case because it's pretty easy to look at the web as something that encompasses the technologies from several years ago in a standard manner, right? So if you look at, there's really two things, well, maybe it's one thing ultimately that has been changing technology. Actually, sorry, there are two things, and these are distinct things, so that have been changing technology dramatically recently. And one is mobile. And I think it's a little bit less of a deal now, but maybe a year or two ago, there was big debates on native apps versus web apps and when is it appropriate to use which technology. But if you look at the web as it stands, the web is so much about nowadays bringing technologies that were only available natively to the web and really unlocking a lot more of the horsepower of a computing device, whether it's a phone or desktop. But really, I think we're focused on phones as an industry right now, or at least mobile, like tablets and phones. And so if you look at some up-and-coming technologies that are on the web now, such as WebGL or the web audio APIs, those will maybe pick up steam. I mean, web audio is a little bit of a no-brainer. That's just a pretty decent API. WebGL clearly has some security implications, some performance implications. And 3D on the web has just never really taken off. Like, I don't know if you remember VRML, VRML, way back then.
Yeah, I do. I've always been a 3D maniac. Well, not maniac, but it's always interested me. And that VRML stuff was kind of hilarious. Like the way you'd walk around like an indoor shopping mall and try to buy stuff and it'd be the demo for the technology. It's like, it's just not useful. Yeah.
I remember very clearly, this was probably back in the late 90s when VRML was coming out and people were really against URLs. They were saying like, oh, I have to type in http://, and www and something.com. That's unnatural. That's not how humans think. Humans think much more like, turn around this corner and go to the right, then walk down two more doors and go to the left. And that's what VRML is. And it's like, those are horrible directions. Who can remember like street directions? No one can.
Yeah. And it turns out humans can change the way they think. Like that's
exactly.
That's, yeah. You know, humans adapt. And if there's anything we do, okay, it's that.
Technologies like bookmarks and Google to compensate.
Yeah, whatever. But I mean, how many goofy hashtags do you see? Like that's, you know, it's just words all mashed together with a number sign in front of it. If you told somebody that that would be popular, it's crazy.
Well, probably when this is released, it'll be old news. But today was, in fact, Twitter's IPO.
Yeah. Are you rich yet?
I'm not buying into that either. One. Yeah. So anyways, going back. So, I mean, I think it's easy to look at, like, 5 years out is not too far out. It's easy to look at what new and native technologies or what native technologies will be brought to the web and gain prominence. I mean, even simple things like getting accelerometer data you can now do. So it seems like there's always kind of this trickle down to the web, and in the web you do it in a slightly more standardized form. And, you know, it seems like the browser wars are still on with Blink versus WebKit versus Gecko versus whatever IE's is called, escapes me at this moment. So
it used to be Trident, but I think they changed it.
Yeah. So performance will still be a characteristic. Mm-hmm. But then the other big aspect to not discount is the notion of the cloud. And I think really one of the industries, and this extends beyond the web, but the web definitely will be impacted. One of the big goals of the entire computer industry is how to have complete ubiquity of all your data. That is to have all my data on all my devices at all times. Mm-hmm. And I think that's really the big question the industry needs to answer. It's really a shame Apple didn't even try doing anything in iOS 7 or Mavericks to improve iCloud at all. But that's where I think we need to go as a technological society, to have all your data accessible at all times. And that's a big question. How the web, I don't know how the web's going to play into that one.
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, remember in the 90s, they had all that thin client excitement from Sun and all that.
Scott McNeely and Larry Ellison.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think the promise of that, or the exciting thing about that, was that your data would be everywhere. And then you could just walk up to any terminal and turn it on and have everything you needed. I don't think you necessarily need a thin client for that. But I think you are right in that, you know, this data ubiquity is sort of the next thing that we need to tackle.
Yeah, I mean, clearly there's, I think the industry has been trying to figure this out for a while, but now it's really a significantly larger issue that we have so many different devices. I mean, even in a simple case, you have a smartphone and one computer, and just syncing between those two is a pain. Just look at photos, for example. Just a matter of photo management alone is a horrible headache right now, because you have a smartphone with a camera and you take, you know, 10 times, 20 times, 100 times more photos than you ever took before. And there's no good ways to manage and synchronize that. I mean, there are some decent or bad ways to do so. I personally use Dropbox, which I think is a great service.
But yeah, Dropbox still is a hacky way to share.
Yeah, it's completely not integrated with the devices as well as it could be.
And EverPix just shut down like yesterday, which was cool. Yeah, too bad.
Did you have a EverPix account? Were you one of the 6,800?
I tested it. I tried it a little bit. I don't know. I don't end up taking that many. Honestly, 90% of my photos are screenshots.
I do.
Because I'm boring.
Well, that kind of... I would say that makes sense. I mean, not that you're boring, but...
Yeah, but yeah, no, you're right. We're getting there a little bit with music and video that you've purchased. Netflix kind of does that. A lot of these RDO, like subscription services, kind of, they don't really address the problem, but they kind of come at it from a different direction.
Exactly. Yeah, it's access to their data.
Yeah, see, it's access to their data rather than your own data. But yeah, it's interesting. Always on web stuff, I think, is going to be a huge, I don't know about benefit. All right, man. Where can we find you on the internet?
So if you want to find me directly, I'm on Twitter. I am JMFD.
Ask what that stands for?
The J and the D stand for Jonathan Deutsch.
Got
you
it.
Can speculate on the M and the F.
Yeah. Most favorable.
I'll take that.
Sure.
Multifaceted.
Multifaceted, that's a good one too. But yeah, if you you know, if you're curious to find out more about my company and Tumult Hype, that's just tumult.com/hype and plenty of good stuff.
I really encourage everybody to check it out. It's a great app, really well done. Honestly, if you can find version 1.0, well, don't do it, but if you look at 1.0 and you realize it was done in 6 months, it's you know, it's a killer app. And two is way better. So please just go check it out. Drop the $30 or whatever it is.
Yep, $29.99 USD.
Yeah, go buy it. Nice. Or never listen to the show again. It's your choice. That's how serious I am about this. Cool. Thanks, man. Continue good luck and continue good looks too. And thanks for coming on and chatting. It's been a blast.
All right. Thanks. It's been fun.
All right. So this will go live next Tuesday. If you I'll grab the usual links, but if there's anything specific you want me to link to, just let me know, shoot it over, or if you have any questions or anything else, just don't hesitate.
Yeah, I mean, just the website, my Twitter account's fine, nothing too special to do there.
And I'll link to a couple Kendo videos just for fun.
Yeah, that'd be good.
I didn't get into it here, but one of my friends here is super into Kendo. Which is why, like, when you started talking about it on stage, it was like, oh, yeah, it's cool. And he was like, I can't remember the name of the guy, but it was like years ago. There was like this 80-year-old Japanese dude. There was just a crazy master kendo guy, and you'd see him do strikes, and it blew my mind that this guy is still so agile and fast, and it's very, very cool stuff.
Yeah, I mean, I've actually fought with someone who was like 8081, and it's just like an amazing experience because they're every bit as good, if not better. Like age, you know, it's some aspects of them are slightly slower, but they're so much more accurate. And in what matters in kendo, like the basics, the fundamentals, the footwork, the accuracy, like they're so much better. And it's like they have this sixth sense that they've been doing it for so long that I think intuitively they know how people are coming at them. And they just like see it, have the reflexes, and can, you know, just react perfectly each time. And
yeah, cool. I wish I could remember the name of
it. Each time.
Yeah, it looked superhuman because it's this little frail old man. Well, he's in armor, so you can't really tell, but you see him in the interviews. And he's just tearing apart like 20-year-olds. Like yeah. As soon as they move like a little bit, it's like there's a sword in their face. It's awesome.
Yep.
Yeah, if you ever watch video of Morihei Ueshiba, we used to demonstrate in football stadiums and stuff. It looked the same way.
Cool,
stuff's always awesome.
Yeah.
Cool. Okay, man. Have a good day. Say hi to Ryan for me, and have a good time.
Thanks. We'll do. Any general feedback you have right now on the interview? I'm always just curious on what
I loved it. I thought it went really well. You know what? It's funny because every interview I start, I look at the clock about 10 minutes in and I'm like, oh, fuck, I'm going to run out of shit to ask. And it's like now been, you know, an hour and 45 minutes. So, no, it went really well. And I didn't know you went to comics and stuff as a kid.
I mean, really, it was more drawing them than collecting them. But
yeah, again, like I didn't interject it, but I for years as a kid, I went back between drawing comics and coding. Yeah. It'd be like 6 months, like flipping back and forth, you know, until I finally got stuck doing a job that pays money, I guess.
Yeah. No, most recently I got a 13-inch Wacom Cintiq, which is like the drawing tablet with the built-in display. And so I've actually been doing some like animation, which is a lot of fun.
Yeah. One of my good buddies did animation in school and it was like, you know, old school onion paper style.
Yeah, exactly. I think there's this lost art. I mean, Disney fired all their like hand-drawn animators. Yeah. And it's going to be a lost art one day.
That's really cool. I'm jealous. You know what I want is better pen input on the iPads.
Yeah.
Like,
a digitizer.
Pen. Yeah, yeah. Rather than the bullshit thing. That
yeah. I mean, the Microsoft Surface Pro and Surface Pro 2 like is getting amazing reviews from artists because it's a tablet. It's maybe no iPad, but it has Wacom input. So yeah. A lot of people are like, well, I can run Photoshop on this and do all my art portably on the go.
Never realized it.
And the Cintiq 13 is like a lot of fun because it's about the thickness of an iPad. The screen's a little bit bigger. Mm-hmm. When I take my Air around, I can have this as like just a second display, which is kind of nice. Unfortunately, it requires a separate power adapter. I would love them to do it all with like one Thunderbolt cable, but I don't think there's the power draw.
Yeah,
you still need to plug it in.
That's really cool. Do you know Gus Mueller?
Yeah.
Yeah. He's got I think he's got like a 30-inch Cintiq or something, like a big one. I'm just so jealous of that. Honestly, I would use it I can't ever let myself buy one of those because it would just sit there and get dusty. But every now and then when I did use it, I'd just love it. Such a great
thing. Yeah, one of the things I started working on, we'll see if it ever develops into a real product, but I started doing some of the basic work, is so I'm doing this animation, right? And there's so much like tedious amounts of work in animation. Maybe tedious isn't the right way, but you have to do a lot of like in-between frames. Mm-hmm. So I want a way to like socially farm out an animation that like I'll do keyframes, but then other people running this program will be like, you should do like this frame. And so I can have like my friends start animating in between frames and just like we can all like socially put together an animation.
Crowd animation.
That is cool. I'm trying to find something for you. Toon Boom. Here we go. You seen Toon Boom? Put it in the chat here.
Yeah, a bunch of my friends work there.
Yeah, yeah. Toon Boom's actually pretty good. That's what I'm using right now.
For years I wanted
Toon Boom like it's not quite the work.
We lost you again, man.
Oh, I would go for it. What were you saying?
For years, I just wanted to make this app. Like, well, this one or the storyboarding stuff. But this is like professional quality stuff. Like, I really wanted to make a cartooning app. But these guys just do such a good job. I don't think there's much point in sort of pursuing that.
Did we lose Jonathan?
I don't know. Well, we can't hear him, so. Jonathan, we can't hear you if you're talking, so.
I'll reconnect him. Whoa. Skype sucks. And it makes me wait before I can recall somebody, which is maddening.
Why? It's like for an anti-spam thing?
I don't know. Anti-user.
Oh. Hey, man. Sorry about that. Yeah, so I wanted to...
There, guys.
Yeah, I wanted to do this app for years, but it's just they're way too competent to...
It's a challenge.
Well, I don't think they're doing anything wrong, and they've certainly got the high-end stuff done, and I don't know if there's a lot of call for like a low-end animation package.
So he can't hear us well.
Yeah,
either.
I mean, I think from a market perspective, it's probably not a good use of time.
Right. From a fun perspective, yeah, it'd be awesome though. All right, man, we're gonna let you go because this is, you know, everything's dying anyway. So, cool. Yeah, talk to you again soon, man.
Okay, thanks a lot.
Have a good one, man.
Ciao.
I hate Skype.